is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Mark Anderson from the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the TBL, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
When you have an expectation of winning, and that's what kids are recruited to, they're not recruited to, you know, to hope or to turning something around or to trying to, yay, we're going to try to win. Like, it's an expectation that when you come here, you win.
Rob Senderoff just completed his ninth season as the men's head basketball coach at Kent State University and ranks as the all-time winningest coach in program history with 181 wins. Rob took over the program in April of 2011 after spending seven previous years on the Golden Flash's coaching staff. In his nine seasons as head coach, the 24-year coaching veteran has continued the success of the storied program that he helped to build by leading the Golden Flashes to six 20-win campaigns and multiple postseason appearances. Kent State has also had success in the classroom, with all 35 seniors graduating in Senderoff's tenure as head coach. Senderoff has led Kent State to the postseason in all eight of his seasons at the helm, participating in the NCAA tournament in 2017 and the CollegeInsider.com postseason tournament in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2015, and 2019. Rob is one of just 14 coaches in the nation with 9-plus years of experience without a losing season. In addition to his time as an assistant at Kent State, Senderoff spent time as an assistant coach at Fordham, Yale, Towson, and Indiana after starting his coaching career as a graduate assistant at Miami University. Don't miss our free Hoop Heads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoop Heads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoop Heads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, and Knuck If You Buck. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Rob Senderoff, head men's basketball coach at Kent State University. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Kent State University, the head men's basketball coach, Rob Senderoff. Rob, welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
How are you doing, Mike? Great to be here. I appreciate you having me, man.
Absolutely. We're doing really, really well tonight. Excited to have you on, dig into Kent State basketball. Want to start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Talk to us a little bit about your first introduction to the game. What made you fall in love with it when you were younger?
Yeah, that's a great question because it brings back some memories. I grew up in upstate New York, Rockland County. Spring Valley is the name of the town. It's about 30-40 miles outside of New York City. That's where I grew up. I grew up playing multiple sports. Baseball and basketball were really the sports that I played growing up. And, you know, it was different back then because it wasn't, you know, a year-round deal. you know, the way it is now, where you played the same sport or you play the same sport 12 months a year. So I played both sports growing up, and in high school, you know, I was actually probably a better baseball player than I was a basketball player. In fact, my teams here, we always have a Labor Day softball game, you know, the players versus the coaches. Part of the reason we do that is because I know we're going to win. I was pretty good, and I got a couple guys on my staff that were pretty good athletes, and it's shocking how bad some of my basketball players are at swinging a bat. So it allows me to look like I'm a decent athlete, which I really wasn't, but played those sports growing up, and played on my high school team, and we didn't have AAU. You know, honestly, didn't play much. You know, just played outside basically in the summer. Went to some camps and did things like that. But you know, my career, as you would call it, ended actually after high school. My playing career in both baseball and basketball ended there. But I have tremendous memories. And really admiration for my coaches growing up. One of my first coaches in high school, he was the junior varsity coach when I was in 9th and 10th grade. I played at Spring Valley High School. His name was Willie Worsley. And I don't know if you've seen the movie Glory Road. Have you seen that
yes.
movie?
Yes.
He was the point guard for Texas Western when they won, you know, the NCAA championship over Kentucky. And he then went on to play in the ABA for a number of years. But Willie Worsley was my high school coach, and really somebody that I always, you know, I don't speak with him often, but I really have a tremendous amount of admiration for him. And you know, one of the influences, you know, growing up was him in my life.
All right. So two things from what you said. One is, how do you think being a multi-sport athlete, when you look back on your high school career, your playing career as both a baseball and a basketball player, how do you think that impacted you being a multi-sport athlete and the benefits from playing baseball when you were a basketball player and vice versa?
You know what? What I really think is that, because I have kids of my own, I have a high schooler right now, and she was a multi-sport athlete growing up, and then, you know, you get older, it becomes harder and harder to do that. And her aspirations weren't and aren't necessarily to play in college. It was more to enjoy the experience of playing sports and all of the benefits that being part of a team and you know, being in athletics brings. You know, my opinion as a parent and as a coach is, if your goal is to play in college, you know, or to play after college, it's unfortunate that I say this, but it is really, really hard if you don't, you know, specialize, so to speak, if you don't spend, you know, 8-9 months of the year with a sport. With that being said, as we all know, you know, 90%, 95% of athletes end after high school. They don't play in college, and they go on to do other things. And the lessons of having played on a team and being part of a team are things that I think benefit you your entire life. And if that's not what it's, you know, all focused on, being able to play multiple sports and being able to be, you know, a high school letterman in 2 or 3 sports and, you know, being able to be that type of athlete for your high school or whatever it may be is such an awesome thing that I really think it depends on the kid and you know, where he or she is looking to get, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road in terms of, do you specialize? Do you not specialize? I do know this, like weightlifting was not even, when I say it wasn't part of the equation, like it wasn't even part of the equation. And now it is, and, you know, it's a big part of the equation, and it's important to be doing those things. You know, I don't know how young, but certainly when you're in high school, it's important to be doing those things to maximize your ability. But things are so much different today when it comes to youth sports than it was, you know, when I was growing up and when you were growing up. And for better or worse, it's just different. And there's some things that make it better and some things obviously that make it tougher. But, you know, that's sort of how I grew up. And look, there's times, because I probably could have played baseball. I probably could have played at the Division III level. I couldn't have played basketball. I got cut from a Division III basketball team. But there's times that I regret having done that, not done it. And then obviously, you know, there's times that I'm happy with what I chose to do.
All right, so let's ask you this about the youth basketball system that we have today, and not that we can totally revamp it and remake it in one night, but just give me an idea of what's something that you, when you compare it to the time when you and I were growing up, what's something that you like about the current youth basketball / AAU system? And then maybe what's something from the perspective of a Division I head coach, what's something that you don't like about the current system?
Yeah, that's a really cool thing to talk about. Well, the things I like, okay, first of all, you know, being able to play year round if you like to play, or you know, it's probably not healthy to play year round when you're young, but having the opportunity to play basketball organized, you know, whether it's 6, 9 months a year for somebody who wants to be good, you know, that's great. Having the ability, there were nobody was going to, you know, a skill session when I was growing. And then when I say nobody was going to
literally nobody.
Up, right? Like they weren't, you know, groups of three, groups of four, working out for 45 minutes, getting shots. People just weren't doing that. The guns, there were no guns where you can get, you know, you can get 500 shots up in an hour. So there's so many things that have been awesome, you know, about the development of a player and the ability to develop as a player that is great for anyone who loves basketball and you know, who's passionate about it and really wants to be good. There's so many opportunities for you to continue to improve that just weren't quite as easily available, you know, say 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So those are really the great things. You know, the things that sometimes are frustrating, you know, would be some of the training is not quite applicable for, you know, real development as a player. Sometimes you watch some of the training videos that you see and you're like, geez, I don't see how this translates. Okay. And there's good and bad, you know, trainers everywhere, just like there's good and bad coaches everywhere. But more even than that is, you know, the idea of games not mattering is what sometimes becomes, you know, to some degree when you're a college coach, it becomes a little bit frustrating when winning and losing isn't, you know, because you play so many games. You can play in an AAU season, you know, 60, 70 games. Well, you know, if I lose a game, no big deal. And that becomes harder, you know, to break that type of mentality that the games don't matter when you get to college, because in college you only play 30 and then you have your league play and you only play 18 or 20. And if you want to be a champion and if you want to, you know, get a ring and if you want to play in the NCAA tournament and if you want to, you know, be remembered forever. You got to win a lot of those games. So that is sometimes difficult, and it's just a product of the amount of games that you play.
How do you fight that as a coach? So what do you do if you have a kid that comes into the program who sort of has that mentality, how do you overcome that? How do you try to instill that desire to win? Because I think what it goes back to the first part of our conversation, that when you think about when you were a kid or when I was a kid, one, you played maybe 20 games in your high school season, 25 maybe if you're lucky to advance in your state tournament. And then in the summertime, I know that for me, there wasn't really AAU per se, but we had a couple teams that, like, my dad was our coach and I was the GM, and we got some people together and played in a couple tournaments. So maybe I played 10 games in a summer, maybe. So in the course of my 1 year as a junior or senior in high school, I might have played 30 games that meant something. And every one of those games for me was like life or death. And to your point, I think kids now, and I see it with my own kids, and I'm sure you've seen it with your own kids and with kids that you watch at the youth level, you know, they lose a game and they're like, are we going to Subway or are we going to Panera after the game?
Because
we know we're playing again in 2 hours, no matter what happens. So how do you fight that as a head coach?
Yeah, you know, I think some of that, you try the best you can is to recruit it, okay, first and foremost. And then the other thing that you try to do is in your practices and in your workouts and in, you know, your drills, is to create a competitive environment where, you know, if you win, there's a benefit. And if you lose, you know, there's, you know, some level of punishment, you know, and I don't want to call it punishment, but some level of, you know, unhappiness. You know, you used to play, again, we used to play where if you lost, you know, there might be 20 people waiting to play. And if you lost the game, you were off. And it may take you, you know, if you're playing outdoors or playing in a gym and there's 30 people or 20 people, and your team lost, and then you had to wait 30 minutes to get back on the court, you know, that was part of the drive to win, is that you wanted to play. So if you lost, you had to sit. So there's some things that you try to do in your drill work that you try to create that competitiveness to where guys don't want to lose, whether it's I got to get more reps or I got to, you know, run. And sometimes the running, it isn't even about, you know, let me – you know, kill them with the running. It's more just the nuisance of having to run, like, or I got to do push-ups or whatever it may be, to create, you know, something competitive so that there is a winner and a loser, and you don't want to be the loser in the drill or in the competition. Even if it's a shooting competition, you know, you have a shooting competition against yourself, you know, or a shooting competition against your teammate, things to help you get better where you just don't want to lose because, you know, there's consequences to losing. And just to add the one other thing, you know, and I think this has been something always, but it seems to be more now, is just because of the individual work that people put in and the amount of time and energy that people put in, the caring about how you do individually more than your team. You know, I just think because the stakes are so high, it seems to be, you know, it just seems to be more important now how I do individually than how my team does. And maybe that's me just getting older. And, you know, thinking back to the glory days of when I was 15 and 16, you know, but it just seems to be a little bit greater emphasis on the individual than there might have been a while back. And, you know, I understand why. But, you know, as a coach, your job is the team. And obviously you want to see each of your kids succeed individually within helping your team win.
So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you about the competitiveness. How do you instill that feeling of team camaraderie? How do you get the guys to buy into each other? Are there things that you do specifically from an activity standpoint designed to do that? Is it just something that you create day after day through the interactions between players and staff, players and players? Just talk a little bit about how you facilitate that team feeling.
You know what? That's a great thing. And in this era, it's even harder than when you played. And I say that because your team is so different each year. You know, it used to be, and similar to high school, and high school is still this way to an extent, but it used to be freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, maybe redshirt freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. 3, 4, 5 years, guys were all together, and the seniors were with the juniors for 3 years, or maybe even four, depending upon, you know, if there's a redshirt or not. And there was a, you know, sort of a hierarchy to some degree, but also, you know, there was just the team developed over time. And that's not the case quite as much now, because you have transfers and you have, you know, guys that play for a year or 2 years and then move on for whatever reason. So because of that, it's even more challenging and more important, the team building part, you know, caring about your teammate's success, rooting for your teammate, wanting to see others do well, even if that means that I may not get to shine quite as much. To me, those are, you know, those are the challenges of coaching today, more so than ever before, for a number of reasons, but as much as any, the fact that your teams are not necessarily together, you know, for so many years. So to me, that's a big part of coaching. Obviously, you have to have, you know, a level of, you know, being able to put in and implement an offense and a defense, and, you know, you have to be sound in your knowledge. But as much as being sound in your knowledge, being able to communicate and being able to get guys to sacrifice, guys or women to sacrifice and make the commitment to each other, those are really, you know, those are the keys to coaching now. And you got to work on that every single, I mean, that's an everyday deal. That's an everyday, you got to work on that every day.
When did you start to come to the realization that that piece of it was becoming more and more important? Was that at some point while you were the head coach at Kent? Was that something that you started to see in your various stops as an assistant? When did you start to really start come to realize that, hey, it's not, yeah, the offense, defense, our skill level, obviously all those things have to be in place. But if we don't have this final piece, we're not going to be as successful as we could be. When did you start to recognize that?
Yeah, that's always evolving, Mike. Like, you know, I think I'm probably better today than I was, you know, last year at that, and probably better last year than I was my first year. You know, we all want to show that we know how to coach, right? Like, I know this and I know that. And, you know, I'm going to sit here and tell you, I probably watch, I don't want to say I watch more film than anyone. I watch as much film as anybody, is my guess. But, you know, as I've gotten more experienced in doing this, it's funny, the less important I think that is to having a good team. And believe me, that's important. Like when you watch, you know, like when you watch, you know, the NBA guys, or you watch good college programs or good college teams, they execute incredibly well, you know, on both ends of the floor. But you don't have to be complicated to execute. You have to be sound and you have to be committed. And how do you get people to be sound and be committed is a great deal of that is getting them to buy into doing those simple things, because they're not going to be on, you know, not all of them are highlights that are going to be on, you know, ESPN or whatever it is. So, you know, those are all the things you have to work on. And again, I think at every level, you know, good leaders and good coaches are able to find a way to get their players to commit to each other at the highest level possible.
Do you think that that's done primarily through your daily interactions and conversations with players just on the practice floor, in the coach's office, when you see them on campus, when you have a player coach meeting? Do you think it's done mostly just through the way that you interact with them, and then conversely the way you sort of coach them to interact with each other? Or is it something that you put in a specific plan for at the beginning of the year?
You know, I think it's a day-to-day deal. I think that's an every day. Look, you can put in at the beginning, you could have your first team meeting and preach, hey, we're going to be a team and we're going to commit to each other and we're going to da 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 da. But if you're not, if that's as far as you go, you know, they're going to hear it. And then 2 or 3 days later, they're going to forget it. And the thing you're battling, and you battle this, and I don't want to say battle, but this is something, again, as a coach, you sort of battle this every day at every level. So I'm with you as a player for 2 hours a day or 3 hours a day. The other 21 hours a day, who's talking to you? And are they talking to you about the team, or are they talking to you about how you're doing? And look, I don't blame a parent or an AAU coach or a high school coach or an uncle or an aunt. If I'm, you know, Mike's on my team and they talk to you at night, they're going to ask you, Mike, how did you do today? How did you shoot the ball? Was coach on you? What did you, like, that's what they're supposed to ask, right? Like, they're not supposed to ask much more than that. Obviously, you know, some people do, but it's understandable that that's what they want to know about. That's not easy for Mike to say, you know what, you know, dad, or I took 2 shots today, but boy, I set some hell of a screens, man. Like, that's not right. Like,
right.
So as the coach, you got to reinforce, you know, all the things. I mean, every person on your team, they may not all have the exact same role, right? Not everybody gets to shoot, but that doesn't mean that the screener isn't as important as the shooter, and the passer isn't as important as the screener, and the guy who goes to crash an offensive rebound who doesn't get it, who maybe tips it so that somebody else gets it. So every day, those are things we reinforce. We have a board in our locker room. I credit this I went to SUNY Albany. There was a coach there. He's a legendary coach. His name is Doc Sowers. He won over 700 games at the Division III level. He came up with this term that I've stolen, and it's called WEGO, W-E-G-O. So we have a WEGO board in our locker room, and the concept of the WEGO board, and this was when I was in college 26 years ago, it still holds true today. Everybody has an ego, but these are the things that help WEGO, W-E-G-O. And, you know, those include diving on the floor for a loose ball, getting a tip. For me, tipping out an offensive rebound is just a huge thing for me. I don't know why, but it just is. It's one of those things that, you know, I could watch guys tip out rebounds and get excited. Most people can't even notice it. That's one of the things that excites me the most of a player.
is when I see them tip the ball out to their teammate. So I have a taking a charge, obviously. We all know that one. You know, so we have a number of things that go on our WeGo board, and at the end of every year we give, you know, our WeGo champion gets his name put up in the locker room, because all of the things that are on the WeGo board are all the things that you don't see in a stat sheet. And, you know, we all as coaches preach those things, but how do we coach those things? And that's the one of the many ways that I try to coach those things. It is through that board. That's, you know, it's the biggest board in my locker room for everyone to see. And this, we have sort of stickers, like a coded sticker. You get a certain number of stickers for different things. So after every game, you know, everyone can see how many stickers I got and how many WeGo points I got for that game.
And I think what that does, and what I, whenever I hear something like that, it always reminds me of the fact that I think sometimes it's easy to look at something like that and say, God, how does that motivate a kid? Like, how does stickers on a board cause somebody to want to do some of those selfless things that you need your basketball team to do? And yet you hearken back to, or you think about when you were a kid and just how important something little like that was. And I have two examples from my life. When I was in elementary school, like fourth, fifth grade, I had a teacher who, he was teaching geography, and you would have to fill out the names of, I think the first one, you had to fill out the states and capitals in the United States. And then you could move on to like the countries in North America. And then you could do the countries of Europe and the capitals and the countries of Africa and the capitals. And each time you knocked off one of these maps, he used to be in the Navy. He had these Navy bumper stickers. And so the first one was easy, and everybody had this whatever blue and white Navy bumper sticker. But then by the time you got to the very end and you were having to like identify the provinces of France or whatever it was this ultra exclusive, which was just another bumper sticker that he had in a drawer from who knows where, but everybody wanted that thing, you know? And it was just, you looked at it from the outside and you're like, how is that motivating? But yet something little that there's that public recognition of, I have that, I'm the leader on the WeGo board, that matters to players. And we sometimes, I think, forget that. And then I also had, when I was playing in high school, we had a JV coach who I never got the opportunity to play for, but he used to give an orange juice out for any player who would get a charge. And literally it was, I mean, I remember players killing themselves to try to take charges so that after the game or the next day in school, this coach would hand them an orange juice. And you just think, and you look at that from the outside, you're like, man, how is that motivating? And yet it really is. And I'm sure that clearly since you discovered this 26 years ago and you're still using it, it clearly works.
Listen, it's amazing that you say that, but at the end of the day, we're all to some level, you know, we all want recognition and positive reinforcement. And we want to know that what we're doing is being appreciated, whatever right. that may be. So if you have a way to do that, you know, that's always a motivating thing. So it's something we always do. We also, you know, in our locker room, we have a defender of the day, a blockout guy of the day. And we call it assist opportunity leader, because not every time that you try to get an assist, does the person make the shot? So we call it assist opportunities. How many times did you have the opportunity to get an assist? So we have that. So after each practice, the next day at practice, there's a couple things we chart. You know, there's a number of things we chart, but those things, two of them are objective. You know, the screener of the day is something, you know, I watch. The defender of the day, I have somebody watch and make a determination of who that person is. and the person with the most assist opportunities, again, trying to create, create not that every good team, not that every basket needs to be assisted, but we do want to recognize trying to make plays for your teammates. So we have those three each day. That one comes off a stat sheet or our own version of a stat sheet that we chart. And then we also chart blow bys, which is how many times, you know, you get blown by on a straight line drive. How many times did that happen in a game or in a practice? In the post, you know, we have an area where we don't want the ball caught in, which we call the red zone. How many red zone catches did you give up? Because on the perimeter, you give up blow-bys. In the post, you give up red zone catches. We have a block-out responsibility. Some guys are supposed to block out. Some guys are supposed to get back. Some guys are supposed to crash. Some guys are supposed to, again, get back. So basically, each guy understands, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do. You know, what percent of the time did you do that? And then the last thing we do each day, and it goes back to one of your initial questions, we keep everyone's record in live drills for the same purpose. Like if you go 2-6 in a day, and then the next day when you're up in the locker room, you see it and everybody sees it, you don't want to be the guy that's 2-6 that everybody's saying, hey, you got your butt whooped, right? So, right. So we keep all of those things up there for you know, team peer pressure a lot of times is greater. You know, when a coach is telling you something, sometimes that gets tuned out. But if your teammates are saying it to you or you're seeing it yourself, you know, that sometimes can have a greater impact. And just to get back to, I had one guy one time tell me that, you know, coach, I'm just not a we go guy. and that's what I'm judging you by, though. So, like, if you're not a we go guy, it's going to be tough for you to play because those are the things that are important to me. So if you are able to emphasize those things, you know, for the most part, the things you emphasize – are the things your teams generally try to do well. I'm not saying they're always going to be great at it, but those are the things you try to do well. You can't emphasize everything, which, you know, everybody knows that. So, you know, you try to pick the things that are important to you and you try to, you know, daily, you know, make that part of your program. And that's what we try to do here.
Yeah, I think we've seen a big trend from coaches we've talked to at all levels that charting wins and losses. I don't remember ever having done that. Even like I've been done now coaching. I think my last year that I coached in high school was maybe 2008, 2009, somewhere in there. And I don't really remember anybody charting wins and losses at that point. And certainly we weren't doing it when I was playing. And so now you talk to coaches at all levels, you hear a lot more people doing that. And I think that goes back to our original conversation about how much does winning and losing matter to kids. And so you got to help them to understand and help them recognize that there's value in winning and that losing has to be, again, to use the word painful is probably the wrong word, but there just has to be some type of consequence associated with winning and losing. And I think charting it, you're starting to see more and more coaches that are doing that. And as you said, then that puts pressure on them because they see it and it's embarrassing to be 1-8 or whatever it might be.
To see
that on the board. They don't want to see that the next day. You certainly don't want to see it 2 days in a row. Let's put it that way.
And quite honestly, sometimes it's better coming from the players than coming from you because to me, all good teams, you know, are player run teams.
If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best, will help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
If the coach is running the team and deciding everything in terms of what's important like that, like the players have to make that important. That's got to matter to them. So, you know, to me, there's coach-led teams and player-led teams. And your best teams are your player-led teams. And those teams, usually the players that are leading, you want them to echo what you would like the way for things to be led, because player-led teams can be
they go a different direction too.
right, but if you have good leadership and the leadership is coming from how you've created that leadership in terms of your coaching of those leaders, and then they're putting the pressure on the players, you know, it coming from a player, hey man, you got blown by three times in today, is a lot more, don't let that stuff happen again, is a lot more powerful than the coach saying that to the player and the player feeling like the coach is picking on me or is trying to point out my deficiency. It's a lot more powerful. And then when the player, you know, if player A tells player B, don't get blown by, it also leads to a level of accountability for player A, because if I'm going to tell other guys, don't do this, or you can't do that, or you need to do that, then I dang well better be doing that myself, or else I'm going to get called out. So that's the culture, you know, of a good team and of a good program. And you know, those are the type of things that you try to develop as a coach. And to me, again, it's more challenging because of the turnover, because of a lot of factors, but because of the turnover in particular of your roster. That's why you got to have a couple things each year. You know, these are the things we're going to be good at. These are the things we're going to emphasize. These are the things that if you don't do, you're not playing. These are the things if you do, you know, you may not shoot the ball all that well, but if you do these things, we're going to find a way for you to play. And then having everybody, you know, be a champion of their role, whatever their role is. You know, those are all things that we coach, and it's not easy, you know, to get buy-in all the time. And that's where having great leadership on your team really, really, really helps you.
All right, so two questions. One, how do you develop and help kids to understand what their role is? So if you need a kid to just be a rebounder and a defender, how do you get that across to them? And then the second part of the question kind of goes to the bigger theme of what you were talking about. With the fact that now at the Division I level, you guys are together pretty much 11 months of the year with off-season workouts and all that kind of thing, I would have to think that if it was the head coach chirping in the players' ears for 11 months out of the year, that eventually that they're going to get sick of hearing your voice as the head coach. So I would think that developing leaders amongst the players has got to be even more important than it was back 15 or 20 years ago when you didn't have the same access to players in the off season. So just talk a little bit about those two things.
Yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, sometimes less is more, right? And those are things that aren't easy to figure out and decide. And, you know, again, especially young coaches, you want to do so much because you want to be good and you feel like your team needs it and you want to do so these things. But guys, they eventually, you know, sometimes the more you say, the less they hear, right? And
Look, that's gone on forever. That's not a new phenomenon. Kids tune out their coaches. So how do you get across what you're trying to get across without, you know, one, having a 30 or 40 minute lecture every day? Nobody wants to hear that, right? And two, you know, how do you keep things fresh and have them have a voice and have your players take ownership? And that's all, you know, that's all part of the season. That's all part of developing your program. And, you know, you want to have your leaders have a voice. You want to have great assistants. You know, for me, especially during the summer, I am incredibly hands-off because I know that I need them to listen to me in January and February. And maybe I'm too aware of it, but I only got so many bullets in the chamber. I don't want to waste them all in July, August, and September. The games aren't until November. So I try to limit, you know, how much, yeah, outside of encouragement and some one-on-one stuff that I'm trying to talk with my guys about. My seniors, I do a leadership workshop with them where we read, you know, different articles and do different things with my seniors every year because I want them to be the voice. And I want to be able to talk to them about – I have a great book that – one of the former players here, Andrew Mitchell, wrote a book, and he, in one of the chapters in the book he wrote, just talked about being a mentor, you know, and how he had mentors in his life that helped him. So we read that chapter with my seniors, you know, and they said, look, this is Andrew Mitchell. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's got his jersey retired. You know, he wrote about being a mentor. You're a senior. Remember when you were a freshman, even though two of my three seniors this year, they weren't freshmen here. They were freshmen somewhere else. But regardless, you were a freshman somewhere. Like, remember when you were a freshman and how you looked up to the seniors or sort of wanted to see how they act. Like, take somebody under your wing. Show someone the ropes. Like, be secure enough about yourself to want to help somebody else. So those are the things that, you know, I try to coach. And then once we start getting into the season and getting into practice and getting into competitive stuff, you know, then I'm much more hands-on. And even then, I do my best. There's times that I let my assistant show film because I feel like if I'm the one doing it, they're not going to want to hear it. So times I let them do it. And then there's times that, you know, you're the head coach, right? You know, I'm the head coach right now. Like, they got to hear me. They may not like it. They may not want to hear it, but they need to hear it. Or in my opinion, they do. And, you know, those are all parts of the season that you work for.
How do you develop your staff and figure out what their roles are going to be and then help them if they have aspirations of eventually becoming a head coach of a college program? How do you help to develop them, and what do you think your responsibilities are as the head coach of a program to help your assistants develop?
Yeah, that's a great question too, Mike. So, you know, at Kent, I've had, you know, I got to think about how many assistants I've had, but I know that – we've had 9 former players here at Kent that I've then hired at some point to be on the staff here. And that's something I'm really proud of because I want guys to know when I recruit them that I'm going to try my best to help them for the rest of their lives. So I've helped, or I like to think I've helped guys get started in their career after they've finished playing for me. As far as the responsibilities, I've changed that up at different times as well based upon some of the strengths of the staff, some of the strengths of different guys within, you know, within the staff. Right now, the way we do it, the way we break things down, and I don't want to say it's the best way we've done it, but it's the best way for us right now, is we have three assistant coaches. Okay. And we have an operations person. Obviously every staff is different. You know, certainly high schools have a lot different deals than colleges, and, you know, different divisions have different deals, but the way we organize the staff currently, I have one assistant that works with our guards, okay, and guards like point guards, combo guards, really ball handlers. I have one assistant who works with the wings, you know, the non-point guards or non-aspiring point guards. And then I have one guy who works with the front court guys. So that's how we break up the workouts. And with those workouts comes film. So I have one guy who shows film to the front court guys. That's who he's showing film to. So those three or four guys or five guys, whatever it is, you know, almost daily, we'll watch some film from practice the day before. Maybe they're watching NBA clips of great offensive rebounders or great post-up guys or great screeners, and they're showing them film on all of that stuff. One guy with the guards and one with the wing. And then for our scouting purposes, we have one coach who does all of the other team stuff. So he's the – I would call him the defensive coordinator. He is not worried about personnel. He is worried about what the other team does offensively and how are we going to combat that. And then each of the other two assistants, they split the scouts. One guy takes one game, the other guy takes the other game, and they alternate it. And they're doing the other team's personnel. So they're going to know the point guard, you know, he likes to use ball screens, the front court guy's a shooter, he doesn't dribble it very well or whatever it may be, and sort of he does the matchups during the games. He's in charge of that, who's ever scouted is. He watches the other team's, you know, their players and knows all that. For the most part, our offense, what we're going to run, for the most part, I handle that. And obviously, I take suggestions. And even with the defense, you know, I have the defensive coordinator, but I would sit here and tell you that if he said, hey, I think we should guard it this way, I'd tell you 8 out of 10 times, I would say, great, that's how we're going to guard it. But there's probably 2 out of 10 times where, you know, I feel like this is what we need to do. And, you know, the loss is going to go on my record. So I'm going to decide this is what we're going to do, you know, 2 out of 10 times. But for the most part, what the defensive coordinator feels is how we should guard actions, and what we should do is how we guard them. The personnel guy, he does 90% of the matchups. Occasionally, again, I may not like a matchup, or I may want us mismatched or cross-matched, so we may do that. But they are in charge of that. And the offensive stuff, what we're going to run, you know, specific quick hitters, they hard-edge ball screens, they switch ball screens, those type of things are mostly things that I would decide.
How much do you use analytics at this point? And is there anything specific that you use that you think is especially valuable as a metric for the success of your team? Or does it vary year to year?
There's a lot of stuff we look at. There is. And you know, I use analytics a lot. I know that, you know, we don't play 82 games the way they do in the NBA, right? So those guys, you know, the analytics of the NBA in terms of like shooting threes versus pull-ups, there's some of those things that I think we incorporate, although I'm not quite as convinced that at the college level, those things are quite as important. I think the game is different in the NBA than in college for a variety of reasons. One of them being the you know, no zone and the shot clock. So I think it's a little bit different, but we certainly use analytics. We use them more for team purposes than we do individual purposes, meaning, you know, I don't know how many times we're going to break down, well, this guy goes right, you know, 70% of the time when he goes right, it's a pull up, and 20% when he goes left, it's a pull up. Like, that's not quite as in depth. We don't get quite that in depth the way they do in the NBA. What we care more about, and I think it's easier for our players to process, is the team stuff. Okay, you know, I'll use Akron, for example. They shoot 42% of their shots are threes, or whatever that number may be. Like, they're ninth in the country in percentage of shots being threes. So, you know, we got to really press up on guys and make them get the ball. Or whatever, they get fouled. You know, they go to the free throw line more than any team in the nation. So you got to make sure, you know, you're showing your hands, all of those little things that you emphasize. But if you know a team is really, really good at something, or conversely, really, really bad at something, you want to emphasize that to your team. And having the statistics, it really helps reinforce, you know, what your eye tells you and what you're trying to coach. Because if you tell somebody they're the number one team in the league in offensive rebounds and they're ninth in the country in offensive rebound rate, listen, fellas, if you're not blocking out today, we got no chance. So then when you do your blockout drills, you can emphasize that being the reason why we're doing them today and how important it is for this game in order for us to have success.
So compared to, like, what you're looking at as a coach in terms of analytics and then what you share with the players, and sort of the same thing goes, I guess, along with film, how much of what you're looking at from an analytics and film standpoint are you then turning around and sharing with the players? If you can put maybe a rough percentage on what you're sharing with your team as opposed to what you and your staff is looking at.
Yeah, so we play a game. I'm going to watch, let's just use a league game. You know, we play a league game. I'm probably going to watch their last four games prior to our game, okay? My assistant may watch their last five or six games prior to our game. I'm going to watch, let's say it's the first time we play somebody this year, first time we play Bowling Green this year. I'm going to watch both of our games against them last year in addition to the, you know, three, four, or five games prior to our game. So I'm going to watch a number of games. My assistants are probably going to watch a little bit more than I am even. Our team, our players, we're going to break that down, and we're going to have usually a 10-minute clip edit of their offense/defense, and usually about a 6-minute clip edit of their personnel. So over the course of 2 days, the way we usually do it is after practice, 2 days prior to the game. So we play on Saturday. Thursday after practice, we will present a scouting report on paper, and we will watch a 10-minute clip edit of the other team stuff. So Thursday prior to a game on Saturday, we're going to do some, you know, 4-on-4 of the other team stuff. We're going to do some 5-on-5 of things that I feel like we need to really work on for that game, offensively or defensively. Okay, and then that after that practice, we're going to watch film, and then, you know, you hope that the players now see, okay, so this is why we did, you know, screen the screener 4-on-4, because they run screen the screener is one of their favorite actions. or whatever it may be. Okay, this is why, you know, against the scout team, we, you know, they tracked every ball screen because we're going to see that. So we do that 10-minute edit, about a 15-minute presentation of the scouting report. That's after practice 2 days before. Then the day before the game, after practice, before practice, we will watch a personnel edit, a 6-minute personnel edit. As I think I said this earlier, the guy who does the team edit is different from the guy who does the personnel edit. So the guy who does the personnel edit is in charge of their personnel for that game. So he does about a 6-minute edit, which basically, you know, it's going to show, okay, the point guard, look at how he uses ball screens. You know, he loves to reject them. And they'll show two ball screen rejects, or, hey, this guy's not great handling pressure. You know, look at what happens when a team gets up in him. So he'll break that down, 6 minutes. And then the day of the game, the last thing guys do after we shoot is they will watch that personnel edit one more time. So the personnel edit gets watched twice. I think players, they care about who their matchup is and what they do. So they want to see that stuff. The team stuff, the team defensive stuff, you know, those are things we work on more than the personnel stuff, but they want to watch the personnel stuff more.
Yeah, you can understand that as a player wanting to go into the game with an idea of, hey, what does this guy like to do, and being able to see that on film. And it's just, again, I'm sure you can attest to back when you first started your coaching career, how much easier it is to be able to watch film yourself, but also to be able to provide film players is just, I don't think anybody who's not, if you're not in the coaching profession today, but you were in it 20 years ago, I don't think you can really comprehend how much better the situation is now than it used to be.
It's unbelievable. That's where, you know, again, there's some things that people talk about technology, and there's certainly, you know, there's some negatives of technology just as general, but there's some advantages to technology too. Like when I was a graduate assistant, I used to have to splice, you know, the film from a VCR to VCR. You know, it was tedious, and it was not easy to do or easy to watch. Even getting film, you used to have to drive three or four hours sometimes to pick up a film, you know, of another team or whatever it may be, just the film exchange. Now to be able to get it all, you know, digitally, all in your computer. Practice ends by the time I sit down in my office, I have the entire practice on my computer ready for me to clip up within 5 minutes. I mean, those things are so much easier for your guys and so much further advanced for your players than they were, you know, years ago.
No question. All right, another digital thing that is a more recent phenomenon is social media. So how do you help your players to navigate what's going on social media in terms of what they're doing, saying? How do you handle that with your players?
Yeah, you know, I have a pretty simple rule. You know, it's a basic rule, which covers a lot of things. Don't do anything that's going to embarrass yourself. You know, embarrass your family name, embarrass our program, or embarrass our university, and that obviously includes social media. So right now, you know, I am incredibly supportive and really want our players, you know, to speak out about some of the things that are going on in this world that we need to really work as a country to get better at and to improve upon. I'm not going to be somebody that would ever want my players to stifle their voice, especially now more than ever. At the same time, I don't want guys, tweeting, lyrics to a song that, out of 80 words, 60 of them are profanity, right? So you have to understand that whatever you put out there, that's up to judgment from others. And we all care about how we're perceived. And all of those things can impact us individually. And you see that all the time. So whether it's, if people lose their jobs for things they tweet and put out on social media. So you have to be very, very conscious of it. It's certainly something we discussed. The one thing I don't allow is if you have an issue after a game, whether it's with me, whether it's with your teammate, whether it's with whatever it may be, don't put that on social media. That's for us to handle. Come to me with it, come to your teammate with it, but don't subtweet. That's what it's called, I think. Don't subtweet your teammate, about this, that, or the other. So that's something we'll discuss as the year gets closer. Again, part of being a man and part of learning how to be a man is you have an issue, confront the issue. Don't confront it on social media. Confront your teammate, confront your coach, have a conversation, and then let's get better from it. So, those are lessons that you learn. And, sometimes you show examples of guys that have lost scholarships or lost endorsements or lost their jobs because of things they put out there. And you hope that people recognize, hey, there are certain ways to go about things and certain ways I can't go about things.
Do you look at recruits' social media as part of your process when you're recruiting?
I know everybody would like to say, hey, look at everything you do on social media because coaches are looking at it all the time. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I look at it all the time, but I do follow the guys that I recruit. I've never, I don't really see, I think for the most part, and again, I may be wrong because you may know this better than I do, but for the most part, I think people sort of know, hey, especially if I'm a recruited athlete, like I got to be careful to some level of what I'm putting out there. I think guys sort of know that. If they don't, there's not many, let's put it this way, there's not many people that I haven't recruited because of social media. There's been a time or so that I've said to myself, dang, man, this dude's on social media. But you know what? There was one time I said that, and we ended up not recruiting. I don't want to say not recruiting. We didn't get the kid, and he turned out to be a heck of a player. So I said to myself, damn, man, I was all critical of him. Maybe I was just critical of him because he didn't come here and he went someplace else. There's people that don't do any social media that don't get in the gym, right? There's guys that do all sorts of social media and they're in the gym all the time too. So I don't know that you could put a blanket judgment, but for the most part, I think guys at this stage, I'd like to think most of the guys that I'm recruiting, they're not putting ridiculous stuff on their social media accounts. Not that I've seen.
Hey, coach, I got to ask you, I was doing some research on you and I see some wonderful Halloween costumes that are on social media from you. Yeah. So what's your favorite Halloween costume that you've worn for is it Hoops for Halloween or what's the event that you're doing there?
We had a thing called Hoopin' Halloween at Kent State where, we had like our dunk contest and all that stuff. Look, I've done a couple different things. One year I dressed up as a blind referee. So that went over really well.
That's the one that I saw, Coach. I liked it a lot. I liked it.
I was once Jackie Moon, too.
Yeah, that was the other one I saw, Jackie Moon from –
Jackie Moon.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, every once in a while I try to show that I'm a real person, not just this
angry coach at all times. So, yeah, I think my blind ref, that was an ode to all the officials out there that that every day you can't stand.
It's funny. That is funny, Rob. All right, let's talk recruiting. If you know, thinking about the social media piece of it, but let's go beyond that and just talk about when you start compiling your list of prospects, guys that you're going to look at, just kind of go from beginning to end, how you first identify a player and then the process that you go through to kind of vet whether or not they'd be somebody that you want to bring into your program, and then how do you go about sealing the deal with them?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you start by obviously you want to see him play. So do you see him play first in a little highlight film? Do you see him play first with their high school? Do you see him play first in AAU? You know, there's all different ways that you see a person play, but I'm going to tell you that if you're going to put together a highlight film, you know, 3 to 5, you know, 5 minutes, you got to have something that jumps off the page right away, man, because, you know, let's put it this way. There's never been a highlight film where somebody misses a shot. There's never been a highlight film where, you know, guys aren't making a play. So you want to jump off the put your best 2, 3, 4 highlights at the beginning. And then, you know, if it's a 3, 4 minute clip, great. I don't need to see you shoot a free throw. You know, like, show me your whether it's range, how quickly you can get a shot off the screen, you know, your athleticism. If there's, you know, a clip or 2 or 3 of your athleticism, so show that in your clips. So I see you play. You know, the first thing we're going to do is make contact, whether it's with the high school coach, AAU coach, or kid. We're going to call one, and eventually we're going to call all of them. You know, I want to have a conversation and sort of see, you know, introduce myself, introduce our program, you know, see if you're receptive, because not everybody's receptive to it. Then we're going to call and find out about the grades, right? Where are you academically? What do you have to do to make sure your grades are in order to come to college? So that's going to be done rather quickly. You know, it may not be the first call, but that's going to be, you know, done within the first 2 or 3 weeks for sure, because we don't want to waste your time and we don't want to waste our time. So we want to know where you stand on that end of things. And then, you know, then really the digging into it becomes like, okay, I've talked with your high school coach. Well, let me talk to your AAU coach. Let me see what he thinks about you. Is what the high school coach says about you the same as what the AAU coach says about you? So, okay, what are other people saying about you? You went to this tournament. You played against this guy. What did that coach think of you? You know, did they think you were tough to guard? Or did they not think you were tough to guard? They're scouting service people that I count on their, you know, their opinion, to hear what they say, hear what their thoughts are. And then it's, you know, family, you know, in terms of the recruiting process, family, coaches, people that are important to the kid, and trying to convince them that this would be a great place for them to continue their career. But there's some, you know, there's some things that you try to sniff out, you know, in terms of talking to coaches. The things you're really trying to learn is competitiveness. Are they competitive? And do they really like basketball? And that's not easy, because sometimes you really like basketball and then you get to college and there's so many other things out there that you start to like some other stuff just as much as basketball. But if you don't really, really like basketball and you're just good because you're good, it becomes hard, man. It really does. It becomes hard. So the other thing I do often, like, we try to get measurables. Like, when guys come on visits,
you know, I do want to know what your wingspan is. Like, I want to know that. I want to know how old you are. You know, we got a commitment. I don't think I can talk about the kid, but we got a commitment from, you know, a 16-year-old front court kid who not everybody recruited him, but we liked him and knew he was young for his grade. You got 18-year-old seniors, and this kid's a 16-year-old senior. So when I know you're 16, I know that you're going to eventually be 18. So you got room to grow, right? So, okay, where are they physically? Because, you know, some guys are physically mature young. Some guys physically mature late. You can get a feel for those things. But there's some, you know, there's some level to play Division I basketball. Like, there's a level of athleticism that you need to have. Like, I'm not saying you got to be able to necessarily dunk or you know, put your armpits in there, but you got to have a level of physicality and slash athleticism. There are some really, really good high school basketball players that, you know, they're just not big, strong, athletic enough to be Division I players, even though they're really, really good. And conversely, there's some really, really good athletes that, you know, aren't skilled enough, don't work hard enough, don't have enough basketball game, you know, to be Division I players as well.
How much do you balance when you're evaluating a player? Maybe this question is off base, but how much do you take into account a player's performance with their high school team versus a player's performance with their AAU team? Or does it not matter because you're kind of looking for things outside of the context of the game, if that makes any sense? Do you value one over the other?
No, I value both because, you know, to me, this is where I think both are really, really important. Okay. For the most part, and again, unless you're at a super team, you know, for the most part, I live in Stowe. If you're in Stowe, Ohio, if you're not the best player on your high school team, you're probably not good enough for me, right? And you could very easily be your best player. You know, Stowe could go 10 years and their best player could not be good enough.
Right.
To play here at Kent, right? But for the most part, you better be your best player. So when you're your best player, you're seeing double teams. You're seeing triple teams. You're counted on to score, you know, 18, 20, whatever points a game. You're counted on to lead. You're counted on to do all of those things. So that's good. That's good for a player to learn how to do that. How do I carry a team to win? How do I score when I'm getting doubled? Or how do I make players better when I'm getting doubled? How do I find different ways to impact the game? So that's good. But it's also good to watch that same kid play with four other Division I players to see how does he carve out a role and be impactful when he only can take four shots in a game. Because for his high school team, he's taking 15, 16 shots in a game. So if he misses two or three in a row, he's still got to shoot them because otherwise he's got no. So those things to me, I think they complement each other well. And I think it's good to see guys in both settings when you can, because I think it's important to be able to. Can you impact the game if you're not scoring? That was part of what we talked about earlier. Like, how do you do that? What are the ways I can do that? How can I be efficient? You know, so there's and then there's the other side. How can I carry a team? How can I do those things? So I want to see them both when I can. And there's times that I want to recruit a guy that, you know what, he may be a high volume guy or he may need to score to be good. But I need a guy to score. Like, that's not easy either. Somebody right. always says, well, he takes all the shots or shoot. You got to be willing to take all that. Like, Not everyone's willing to do that. You got to be willing. Like I had a kid, Jaylen Walker, guys used to, you know, he took some crazy shots now, but he also led the league in scoring. And his senior year, you know, he had six game winners in the last 30 seconds of a game, six in a year. If he didn't shoot some bad ones, or if I yanked him for shooting some bad ones or barked at him early, he might not have made those late. So, you know, you got to be able to do both. Or you don't have to be able to do both. Let me take that back. You don't have to be able to do both. But it's important for me to see you when I can in both settings, to see how you handle both settings, because they are different. And I do think they're both equally valuable in terms of trying to evaluate for how good you can be as a college player, in my opinion.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think being able to see a player in a different role, because clearly not every kid who's the best player on their high school team is coming in to be the best player on their college team. And oftentimes far from it. So you got to be able to see, can this kid fit into a system? Can they play a role? Can, as you said, can they impact the game in ways other than just putting the ball in the basket? So I completely understand that. One final recruiting question. Have you ever had a kid that you were recruiting that you were pretty high on, you brought him in for a visit, he hung out with your guys, and your players came to you and said, "Coach, this guy's just not a fit"? Has that ever happened?
That's happened. It has. That has happened. I've had a couple times where my team has not liked a kid that, you know, whenever I bring you on a visit, not every time, but most of the time, it's because I am pretty much sold on you, right? Like, I think you can play. I'm not wasting, you know, all those resources for the most part just to see. So, right, you know, but whether it was in how they interacted with my team or how they played when they were with my team, I don't watch them when they play. I'm not allowed to, but the players have come to me, and I can think of a couple of instances that has happened. And I also can think of a couple of instances where I was, you know, I was somewhat lukewarm. I liked them. I wanted to bring them in to see how much I liked them. And during the visit, how they acted and how they were with my team sold me more on a player. So it's happened both ways, but without question, you know, I don't want to sit here and tell you that I'm going to, if I've watched a kid play 30 times and then they have a bad open gym and my players are like, "Oh, he can't play," I'm not going to always listen to them on that one. But if they tell me that, you know, personnel, you know, some things may be off the court, or he wanted to do this, or da 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 da, or the kid doesn't want to interact at all with my guys, that there have been some red flags that certainly have come up through visits that have led me to, you know, sort of walk away and, "Hey, let this one go someplace else" type deal.
Understood. All right. I want to ask you sort of an overarching question about the Kent State program and just looking at the sustained success over the last 25 years and going through a bunch of head coaches. And now you've had a long tenure there and had sustained success there. What do you think, if you could boil it down to a 30-second answer, a one-minute answer, what makes Kent State basketball such a special program, and what's allowed you guys to continue to have the success that you've had year in and year out?
Well, listen, man, it is hard. I'm not going to lie to you. It is hard. It's hard to sustain success. It's hard to win. You know, the league has continued to get better and better, and more programs have invested more and more schools have invested in their programs. So it's hard, but what we've done is we've created, I don't want to say it's a culture, but it's an expectation of winning. And when you have an expectation of winning, and that's what kids are recruited to, they're not recruited to, you know, to hope or to turning something around or to trying to, yay, we're going to try to win. Like, it's an expectation that when you come here, you win. And when you don't, it's disappointing. I'm not saying it's not disappointing everywhere, but it's really what kids have become accustomed to when they come here. And look, Kent does not have – we have nice facilities, but we don't have the best facilities in the league. We have a good budget. We don't have the best budget in the league. We give out really good gear to our players. We may not have the best gear in the league. I don't know all those things. I know some of them. I don't know all of them. I do think we have the best practice facility in the league, but that just built, was opened up this past year. But there's a lot of things that maybe we don't have. But when guys come here, they're coming here knowing that we win and that that's part of the deal. So when you come here, we're trying to win. And, you know, we get them from everywhere. And we got guys that I think have a chip on their shoulder. And there's a type of kid that I recruit in terms of I want them to be hungry and I want them to feel like they have something to prove. But I don't care where you're from. I don't care about a lot of those other things. But I do care that you want to win. And that's something that we recruit to. We recruit. In our recruiting, that is a huge – I don't always talk about the individual, what we're going to do. We're going to win. That's what we're going to tell you. We're going to win. So those are things we really, really emphasize a lot in that process so that when you get here, you know what, because we don't charter flight, and some teams in our league do. You know, so there's things – so when you're not, if you're going to sit here and tell me, well, coach, I don't do this and those guys. Well, I didn't tell you we were doing that. I told you we were going to win. That's what I told you. So that's what we're doing. So those are the things we really have recruited to. And I think that's allowed us to try to find the right guy. And not that it always worked out, but that's what we try to do.
Yeah, and that makes total sense. When you set the expectation and when guys come in with that mindset and you're recruiting guys who have had that mindset through their career up until the point that they enter college basketball, I think you're much more likely to have that happen. And to a certain degree, not that it's self-sustaining, as you said, it's hard work. It's not something that just right. You roll the balls out and it happens. But once you've established that it can happen and then it does happen, it's, I got to believe, at least easier to instill and get that belief and buy-in that we talked about earlier from your players that, hey, if we do the things that this program has always done, we're going to be able to be successful. And so just to be able to have that belief, I'm sure, is very, very powerful. So we're coming up, Rob, close to an hour and a half, so I want to be respectful of your time. I want to ask you one final question, a little two-parter, and that is, first one, when you get up in the morning, what's your biggest joy as the head coach at Kent State? And then number two, as you look forward, once we get beyond this pandemic, because I think probably you could answer my question easily by just saying that, once we get past that, what's your biggest challenge as you look forward into the future to try and sustain the success that you've already had?
Yeah, my biggest joy, and I don't know that I'd say it every day that I think this, but my biggest joy is that, okay, I've been the coach here for 9 years. 35 of 36 seniors have graduated. I think it's 22 or 23 of them have had a chance to play after college. And I mentioned this earlier, 9 former players have started coaching here for me. Although one of them, 9 are in coaching. One of them I helped get a GA spot someplace else because we didn't have a spot for him here, but I helped him get a job. So 9 former players I've helped get a job in coaching. So when I look at that, you know, again, I don't want to blow my own horn here, but I feel like I'm trying to have an impact on these dudes, on the guys that I'm recruiting. So when I see that, that brings me joy
And that brings me a sense of pride and satisfaction. And something that I'm probably more proud of than any wins is that part of it. Okay. And then in terms of challenge or what I'm looking forward to, you know, obviously I hope we play this year. I mean, let's start there. But the challenge is going to be this summer. You know, I didn't get 8 weeks with my team. Some schools in our league did. They were able to bring their players on campus for the whole summer or part of the summer. We did not for whatever reason. You know, we didn't have all of our players here. So this week was our first week of workouts with our guys. And we're still far from, you know, the point of playing 5-on-5 or being allowed to do that here on campus. So, you know, we're starting out in 1-on-1 and then we're going to get into 3-man groups. And then, you know, maybe we'll be allowed to do 1-on-1, 2-on-2, and knock on wood, we're able to get to that point, you know, and we don't have, you know, breakouts here on campus or within my team. So the biggest challenge is going to be, I'm normally 8 weeks ahead of where I am in terms of team building, in terms of where we are offensively, defensively, my knowledge of my players. I have 7 new players on this year's team, plus 2 walk-ons. So really it's 9 out of 15 guys, you know, 7 scholarship guys. So the biggest challenge is going to be, and it's actually going to be fun, is putting these guys together to create, you know, the team that we want to create here. And I do think we have the talent to do it. I do think we have the leadership to do it. So now the challenge is in, you know, it's in the process of doing it. And that's going to be fun. It's, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you every day it's going to be fun. During the summer, I'm like, I don't even know what this dude looks like, let alone what he can do on the court. How am I going to decide what we're going to – somebody asked me, what are you going to do on offense this year? You know what? We're going to try to score more points than the other. Yeah, because I haven't seen it. But we're going to play a certain way because that's how we play. But, you know, the details of that, of how we're going to play, it's going to be fun getting that together, but it's also going to be a challenge. And I'm looking forward to that and really hoping that we can get to that point, obviously.
All right. It's really, I think, a great answer. And I think probably a lot of coaches would echo that sentiment of just trying to figure this thing out and continue to work and help their players get better and improve. And I think speaking about helping your players later in life, that's kind of been a theme that has run through the podcast in terms of when you think about what coaching is. It's certainly the X's and O's that we talked about. It's certainly the team building within the context of your given season or your given 4-year career as a college player. But it's really about impacting your guys long beyond the time when they're right in front of you. And you really see what you've done pay off 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road when your guys are successful as coaches or successful as business people or have successful families and marriages and all those kinds of things. And that's really what it's all about ultimately when we get down to it with coaching. And I can't thank you enough, Rob, for taking some time out of your schedule to jump on here with us and spend an hour and a half and talk this about the Kent State.
I don't know what time you play this, but this is past my bedtime.
Hey, man, this is our time. It's funny because we both
we do our NBA podcast at like 12:30 at night, man.
Yeah, sometimes we'll start those. We wait till everybody in our respective houses go to bed. And Jason has a now. How old is Ellie now? 6 months, Jay?
She's 7 months now, Mike. Can you believe that?
It's getting too fast. So he has a 7-month-old. So he sometimes trades off with his wife, and so this is actually not that late for us. But nonetheless, we appreciate you staying up late with us and just being willing to come on and talk Kent State basketball. We really appreciate it. And if before we wrap up, I don't know if you want to share where people can follow Kent on social media, just or how people can reach out to you if they have questions or want to find out more about the program.
Yep. We have a Twitter, you know, our men's basketball, Kent State men's basketball. I have my own Twitter that I put a lot of the stuff that we do on Kent State. I think it's my Twitter is at Coach Sendy, S-E-N-D-Y. You know, Kent State men's basketball, our website, Those would be the ways to get information on us. And if anyone has a question, they can always email me. Practices, assuming that we're allowed to have them open, they've always been open to coaches. We usually practice 12 to 3 is our practice time. But my email address is rsendero@kent.edu, rsendero@kent.edu. You know, if there's any questions or anything that I can ever do to help a coach in the area or whoever may be listening, I'd be happy to do that.
Thanks a lot, Rob. We really appreciate it. And we'll put all that in the show notes so people can find it. And as I said a few minutes ago, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's a lot of fun to talk Kent State basketball with you. And I'll look forward to seeing you in person again, hopefully at some point when the season comes back online and we can actually get in the gym and play some basketball. So thanks to everyone out there who's listening tonight. We really appreciate it. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.